directly to the front, eh? You can do the final.
You have to be aggressive. If you're not aggressive, you're not in the race.
Is it a little bit uncomfortable that you've got guys that people say, we don't really like the fact that you've got this ex-doper on your team and so on and so forth? Yes, that's extremely uncomfortable.
I'm very busy, but I always find a little bit of time for our listeners, for you.
With exclusive interviews and the best analysis on two wheels, this is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast.
Hello, my name is Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
And Daniel Freeb.
Hello, chaps.
Now, in today's packed episode, we have got a roundup of all the racing that's going on as we speak. We're going to talk a little bit about Alberto Contador as well, who is apparently intending to retire at the end of next season, 2016. And we think that there could be a sort of mass exodus at the end of 2016. So we'll talk about Contador, maybe some of the other big names that might be bowing out. Daniel has brought us an interview with the Vuelta director, Javier Guillen, and we'll hear from him, talking a little bit also more broadly about the Spanish cycling situation and the dearth of big stars to follow in the wheel tracks of Contador. But first of all, Lionel, can we have a little roundup of what's been going on?
Yeah, we can. The racing is underway now, isn't it? All eyes are on the Middle East, with the Tour of Qatar having finished last week, won by Nicky Terpstra, who clinched the overall by winning the time trial ahead of Fabian Cancellara and Bradley Wiggins. Alexander Kristoff of Norway won three stages. He's looking good to have a crack at repeating his Milan-San Remo victory last year. In fact, Kristoff, Mark Cavendish and John Degenkolb all looking pretty good at these early stages of the season. Cavendish won the Clásica de Almería in southern Spain at the weekend. Should mention Sam Bennett as well, who is from Sean Kelly's hometown, Carrick-on-Shore. He wasn't actually born there. He was born in Belgium because his father was a Belgian professional footballer. But his hometown really is Carrick-on-Shore. He won the final stage of the Tour of Qatar. I'd say that's a kind of breakthrough win for him, really. Certainly the biggest win he's had so far. Now the Tour of Oman is underway. The Ruta del Sol will be underway by the time you listen to this, and the Tour of Algarve. So the stage races that lead into the season proper are in full swing, and we're just over a week away from Het Nieuwsblad. Off the bike, Bradley Wiggins has unveiled his new team jersey for the Team Wiggins. Exciting Team Wiggins. It's basically a remake, a reimagining of the Great Britain national team jersey from the mid-80s, predominantly blue but with red sleeves, a kind of a bit like a reverse of an Arsenal shirt, perhaps, Daniel. And finally, Lance Armstrong has been ordered by a court in the US to repay more than $10 million to SCA Promotions. That's the company that basically insured Armstrong bonus scheme and system. As he racked up Tour de France victories, he collected ever bigger bonuses, which he invested in building up the US postal team, really. Bob Hamann, he is the boss of SCA Promotions. He's fought a long game here, hasn't quite got all of his money back. And I should perhaps just say that Bob Hamann, I've spoken to him a number of times over the years about his quest to recover this money from Armstrong, and his voice is the voice upon which US Marketing Guy is based.
The late US Marketing Guy, sadly deceased.
Tragically deceased, yeah.
He was pulled into a shredder by his tie, if I recall correctly. I think we might still be able to resuscitate him. Is he not being played by Dustin Hoffman as well in the film, the forthcoming Stephen Frears Armstrong film? Dustin Hoffman, can you see that?
That does ring a bell. Dustin Hoffman is in it, isn't he?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it's Dustin Hoffman, which is completes a little circle of Dustin Hoffman's own, because he was slated to play the lead role in a film about the Tour de France that was in production in the mid-80s, and there are photos of him with Greg LeMond at the 85, maybe 84 tour as well. A lot of footage shot at that time, which seems to have been lost forever. Anyway, going on a little bit of a tangent here, Mark Cavendish, we were going to just spring from your roundup there, Lionel, into a kind of look ahead a little bit towards Milan-San Remo, because the top sprinters are jockeying for position. It's been confirmed now that Marcel Kittel will not be riding, as we suspected. The giant Alpecin team. I used some Alpecin shampoo this morning, actually. I'm pleased to report. How's my barnet looking?
Nondescript, as usual.
Thanks very much. Anyway, John Degenkolb, as we suspected, is leading the team there. He's obviously in great form. But Cavendish is in very good form, isn't he? When's the last time he's won as many races as he's won so far this year, Daniel?
Well, he's won 5 already, hasn't he? You've put me on the spot there, Rich. I don't know, but he certainly had a rip-roaring start to the 2015 season. You mentioned Degenkolb there. Our little teaser on the podcast last week about Degenkolb possibly being on Etic's Quick Step shopping list generated a little bit of buzz. And just to elaborate slightly on that, I know that the management there at Etic's Quickstep are thinking ahead. We're going to talk later about riders who might be retiring at the end of 2016. Boonen has not committed to retiring then, but it's certainly a possibility. But they find the prospect of Degenkolb doing perhaps one season with them under Boonen's tutelage, I know, quite sort of mouth-watering. I think it depends a lot on how the potential replacements for Boonen at Etic's Quickstep fare this classic season. So Terpstra, who's in very good form, the reigning Paris-Roubaix champion, Stibar, the former cyclocross maestro, he is due, I think, or he certainly would like to have a very strong classic season. But they've also got some young guys, Guillaume van Kersbulk, Yves Lampert. So depending on how
Matteo Trentin, is he not a potential cobbled classics guy as well?
Could be. I think Trent is one of those guys who's yet to really find his speciality. He's had success at the Tour de France in the last couple of years, hasn't he, winning stages? But I think depending on how those guys do, they may or may not put in a very big offer for Degenkolb. And of course, whether Giant Albertsen can keep Degenkolb probably depends on how many races he wins and what races he wins this year. Because if he were to win a big classic, a monument maybe, I think their budget might not stretch to keeping him next year.
You're listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast with Richard Moore, Lionel Burney and Daniel Freeb.
A little reminder that our first Friends of the Cycling Podcast special was released last week, a Team Sky special looking back at the first 5 years of Team Sky. Thank you very much, everybody who's become a friend of the podcast by paying a fiver through our website, thecyclingpodcast.com. Not too late to do that, just go on there and pay your fiver and get access to the first special podcast, first of 11 that we'll be producing this year. Details very soon on the next one, which we're all quite excited about, I think. We've got some good plans for the next special and for specials thereafter. Before we go on to talk about Alberto Contador, I'm very pleased and relieved to hear somebody else putting their neck on the line with transfer gossip and speculation, because of course it was a cycling podcast that broke the news last year that Edvald Boasenhagen would be joining BMC and that Geraint Thomas would be leaving Team Sky.
He joined MTN, didn't he? So it was just a typo.
It was a typo. The sort of oral equivalent of a typo. And as for Geraint Thomas, well, not quite sure. He's still at Sky last time I checked, so somebody got that wrong.
And we should add a little bit. I should add a footnote to the prior discussion about John Degenkolb. He is actually under contract still with Giant Alpecin for 2 more seasons, so until the end of 2016. I'm not sure if there's any kind of release clause, but I'm sure they would find a way of making a divorce happen if he wanted to leave and Etic's Quickstep wanted him badly enough.
Could depend on what the Alpecin shampoo does for his hairline, because there's a guy who might benefit from that shampoo a little bit. Not
why are you looking at me here? It's too late for me, Richard. Mine's all gone.
Well, you'd be a great advert for it, Lionel, if we were to see some kind of rebirth there. Let's talk about Alberto Contador, who seems to have hinted that he will retire at the end of the 2016 season. He'll be 33, effectively turns 34 in December of 2016. Quite a young age to retire. He's kind of Bernardino-esque. He retired on his 32nd birthday. But it struck me as slightly odd, given that I would have thought Alberto Contador would have quite a lot of unfinished business, Lionel.
Well, yeah, I mean, he's got an impressive list of Grand Tour victories, the Giro, the Tour and the Vuelta. I always forget which ones are valid and which ones are no longer valid. It gets very confusing when totting up his palmares of race victories. But, yeah, it seems strange that, riders do perhaps put a time limit on how long they're going to go on. I remember Tom Boonen saying he wouldn't go past his 30th birthday, and You know, I think that's turned out not to be the case. Chris Froome talked about trying to win 7 tours in a row after he'd won his first one. Obviously, you know, that would have extended.
I didn't hear that.
Oh, yeah, he said something about, I want to win, try and win 7 in a row. Yeah. I mean,
anybody ever done that?
Not officially, no. But Contador, he remains quite an enigmatic figure, for me at least. You know, his explosion on the bike, it's always entertaining to watch. Eventually, that is going to start ebbing away from him. And perhaps he will just bow out before his powers fade rather than sort of grind on. I mean, he's not the sort of rider that you could see reinventing himself as something else. It's not like Valverde, who's gone on longer and can win one-day races. Contador's not exactly... He's not prolific outside of the Grand Tours, is he? He's not somebody
He is in stage races, but never in one-day races.
No, that's what... Yeah, exactly. Not he's not a one-day racer. I don't know why that would be.
Yeah,
I mean, it is strange, isn't it? I mean, but loads of riders over the years, particularly the Spanish Grand Tour riders, you'd think, well, they could possibly win a Liège-Bastogne-Liège. They've got seemingly all the attributes, but just, have never managed to do it.
We should say that there was no official announcement. It is quite ambiguous. I think that he hinted that 2016 would be his final year, but it's certainly not been something that's been confirmed officially, so it might be subject to change. But yeah, it's interesting that he's had a strange career. I mean, 2007, you know, is a long time ago when he won his first tour, almost by default, because Michael Rasmussen would have won had he not been thrown off the race. And he went on and didn't ride in 2008, but won in 2009 and 2010, stripped of his title. I don't think anybody imagined then that, you know, we'd get to 2015 and still be wondering when Contador would win the Tour again.
He was a guy who was always tipped for great things. I remember speaking to Manolo Saez, who was his team director at ONCE, I think it still was at the time, in 2004. I don't think Contador was even riding in that Tour, and I spoke to Saez about up-and-coming talents, and he said, well, Contador's going to debut at the Tour. We think he's going to finish about 30th. He actually went on to finish, I think, 33rd in his first Tour in 2005. And then the fight, or the sort of three-year plan that they had for him was to finish top 10 the next time. 2006, he didn't actually ride, did he? Because he was booted out by virtue of Operación Puerto. And then he duly came back to the Tour. So it was only his second Tour de France in 2007, and he won it. And he was up and running then, wasn't he?
Yeah, and I think one of the aspects of his life, rather than just his career, that's overlooked is that he overcame serious adversity himself. He had an aneurysm when he was he a late teenager or early 20s?
It was during the Vuelta a Burgos or Asturias, one of the two, in his first year as a pro.
So 2004, yeah. So, you know, he's come back from something as serious as, you know, Greg LeMond's shooting in the hunting accident and Lance Armstrong's cancer, and he recovered from, you know, a very serious health problem and became a top level cyclist, and the progression was there to be seen, really. But as you say, Daniel, missing the 2006 Tour because of Operation Puerto, and it wasn't quite Astana at that point, was it? It had become Astana Worth, I think, after Liberty Seguros pulled out as a sponsor. The team were kicked out of the Tour de France on the eve of the race, along with Alexander Vinokourov. So when he then came back in the 2007 Tour, and he was rivaling Michael Rasmussen, and they were going shoulder to shoulder on the Col d'Or Bisque, the day before, the day that Rasmussen was ejected from the race, pulled out of the race really by his Rabobank team, suddenly Contador was a star. He was riding in the white jersey at the time. He inherited the yellow jersey. He was riding for Johan Bruneel's team, Discovery Channel, that's where it all gets so messy and confused, doesn't it? You know, the son of Saez, the son of Bruneel, and a man who has dominated Grand Tours and has been stripped of some of his titles because of a positive test for clenbuterol.
And, you know, one of these unrepentants, I mean, has always protested his innocence with regard to the clenbuterol case, fought tooth and nail to be exonerated. It took his case to the Court of Arbitration for Sport, and certainly feels that he was a victim of some kind of contamination. The steak story was the one that he offered, that he ate contaminated steak. And there have been a few clenbuterol cases since then, of course, but they've all originated in China or Mexico. There haven't been any, as far as I'm aware, in Europe. So That would have been a real anomaly, very extremely unlucky, if that is indeed the reason. And you know, when he did come back and won the Vuelta, having just returned, I think he held up seven fingers to indicate seven Grand Tour victories, which included the ones that he'd been officially stripped of, which was the 2010 Tour title and the 2011 Giro. And yeah, messy is the word, isn't it?
Yeah, Lionel, you alluded there to not remembering exactly how many Grand Tours he'd won. I think that aside, the victories that he was stripped of aside, I think there is an ambivalence about his legacy, about a rider who would have had a certain sort of place in the pantheon without those doping controversies. One of the very best stage racers there's ever been. I mean, even when Nibali won the Tour last year, he joined a very select group of riders who had won all three major tours. That club also includes Alberto Contador, and that is also disregarding the way in which he's won them, the sort of swashbuckling style, which has really been unique in this generation of riders. We've seen a lot of a fairly sort of robotic performances from Grand Tour winners over the last 10 or 20 years. Contador has really broken with that trend and excited an awful lot of us with his racing style. However, like I say, his place among the very greats of the sport, the Merckxes, the Enos, even the Indurains, it's really up for discussion.
This is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Join us on Twitter and Facebook. Just search online for the Cycling Podcast.
Just to broaden out the Contador discussion a little bit to Spanish cycling as a whole, because I mentioned the big stars of Spanish cycling are all getting deep into their 30s now, and there is seems to be quite a dearth of talent coming up behind. Daniel, you recently met with you were at the presentation of this year's Vuelta, and you met with the director there. Can you introduce the first part of your interview with him?
You talked there, Rich, about Contador's retirement, and you know, one of the themes we've discussed in the past few months has been the sort of power vacuum that Contador will leave behind in Spanish cycling. There's not a lot of talent coming up, and this is obviously a big concern for the Vuelta a España, a race that's had problems in the past sort of 10 or 15 years, just generating interest. And you can imagine that's going to be even harder when Contador goes, Rodriguez goes, and Valverde goes. So I spoke to Javier Guillén at the Vuelta presentation in Malaga about what a concern this was for his race.
I really worry about that. In the last, I don't know, 10 years, Spanish cycling has been the best, in general terms, you know. And we have had Alberto Valverde, Purito, before them, Carlos Sastre, all Sanchez. Of them, you know, in the same time, you know.
Sanchez.
But now, you know, we see that nobody in the beginning is coming. We don't know, because at the end we need those Spanish riders. The base is very good. You know, we have people that you can see, you know, from the young people or better. But for sure, this is a point that everybody is very worried in Spain. Vuelta is very worried. I don't know, we have to keep working on cycling, on the base. We develop Vuelta Junior. We are so close from our national federation, but here we have 2 points. Apparently nobody's coming, and secondly, we have had 10 years which are very difficult to repeat. I mean, the current level is very difficult to reach, you know, but for sure we are worried about that, totally worried.
So that's what the Vuelta director thinks about the dearth of Spanish talent. What are your theories behind the lack of interest in the Vuelta and in the sport as a whole in Spain, Daniel?
There are several sort of strands to the problem. One is obviously economic. It's no secret to anyone that Spain has had a very hard time of it the last few years economically, much like Italy. This has led to been fewer races, particularly in the under-23 category. We should point out that Spain has never really had a fantastic record of producing riders that have succeeded in world championships. For instance, under-23 world championships have got a very, very poor record. And the only two sort of standout under-23 performers in the last 20 years that have come from Spain have been Oscar Freire and a guy called Miguel Moras, who most people will have forgotten didn't have any kind of pro career of note. So their riders have not shone at that level, but they've got around that problem in the past by having a lot of sort of continental division teams, professional division teams, and a lot of guys turning pro. Now, In the past few years, the money has dried up. There are not many races at under 23 level, by extension, not many teams. I did a bit of research, which is kind of unusual for us, before the podcast this week. Look, just out of curiosity, was looking at the number of teams in the Vuelta a España, Spanish teams, in the past. I just plucked one Vuelta out at random. 1998 Vuelta, there were 7 Spanish teams. Last year, there were 2 Spanish teams. The Ruta del Sol, which starts this week in Spain, there are going to be 3 Spanish teams. That's all. Only 1 World Tour team. So even that tells you how few opportunities there are. And I think what's been happening in Spain is that a lot of the guys that are racing in the under 23 category realise that there are only very few spots available to turn professional, very few opportunities. And, you know, after a year, 2 years, 3 years in the under 23 category, they probably lose motivation because they realise that their opportunities are very, very limited. And consequently, a small handful are turning pro every year. Are they? We don't know whether they are the most talented guys. I was speaking to the former Sonia Deval direct sportive Machin at the Vuelta presentation. He's now working as a scout for Etics Quickstep, and one of his briefs is to find talent in Spain, and he said that the talent is definitely there, but it is very, very difficult to locate it because you know, there are so few races, so few teams.
Historically, if you look back at Spanish cycling, I've talked to Sean Kelly about this in quite a lot of depth because he rode for a number of years with the CAS team, a Spanish team sponsored by CAS, a manufacturer of soft drinks, in the 80s. And they had a team that went all the way back to the 50s, I think, late 50s, 60s. And when you look back at the history of the Vuelta, it's the youngest of the 3 Grand Tours. It perhaps isn't as deserving of the title Grand Tour as the other two. It was a long while before it expanded to 3 weeks. Even in Sean's years in the 80s, sometimes it's only 16 or 17 stages rather than the 21 or 22 that we associate with the Grand Tours now. And of course, in those years, before the switch in the mid-90s, it had a significant calendar change. The Vuelta used to be run in late April and May. It overlapped a little bit with the classics, and it overlapped occasionally with the Giro, but it certainly butted up right up against the Giro.
But a lot of riders in those days did ride all 3 still, when they could.
When they could, they did, yeah. But if you look at the start lists of the Vuelta, even in the early 80s, when the Tour was moving up to sort of 150, 160, and eventually 200-man fields, the Vuelta was still sometimes, you know, 90 riders. You know, it was a small race in comparison, heavily dominated by the Spanish domestic riders. Not many teams from abroad necessarily went there. And I suppose of the 3 biggest countries, France, Italy and Spain, in European cycling, certainly in stage racing terms, the Spanish system was perhaps the most self-sufficient. As Sean said, if Cass had had their way, he would have just done stage race after stage race after stage race in Spain and never would have bothered with anything else, because they are quite insular looking. A victory in the Tour of Flanders or even Paris-Roubaix didn't resonate as much with the Cass company as winning the Tour of Burgos or Castilla y León. That's it. The Trofeo Castilla y León. All of those names of those races escape me now, but you used to look at the calendar and it would just be week after week of Spanish stage racing, and that to an extent has disappeared, all but disappeared.
A lot of Spanish commentators are quite defensive of the role that doping has played in this dearth of Spanish talent, and they tend to attribute that phenomenon more to economic factors. I definitely do think doping has played a role, in the same way that it has in Italy. You know, we've had this fantastic generation of Spanish riders, but I'm not sure that their successes have resonated to quite the same extent as they would have had there not been the confusion we talked about with Contador. You know, this has been an era when Spain has had a fantastic tennis player, Rafael Nadal, has had a fantastic Formula One driver, Fernando Alonso. And I think Contador has perhaps not been as big a star as he would have been in any other era, because cycling has confused people in the way they perceive the sport. And I think that's compounded the economic issues. And, you know, we've seen in France how the sort of cleanup post-Festina forced the teams, under 23 teams, junior teams there, to develop their ideas in terms of sports science, physiology, structure of a federal level, and in terms of the calendar. You know, they've created races, they've been very careful about the way their guys have trained. I think in Spain, the success of people like Contador lulled lulled the whole sport in Spain into a false sense of security. And, you know, they haven't developed sports science physiology in the same way that they have in countries like France and the UK, for instance.
It's interesting in terms of how Contador resonates among the Spanish people, because we're often sort of told or led to believe that there's a sort of ambivalence towards doping in Spain and Italy. But from what you're saying there, Daniel, suggests that actually there isn't an ambivalence, that perhaps there might be an ambivalence within the professional milieu in Spain, among the riders and teams, etc. But among the wider public, that failure to connect in the way that he perhaps should have done can be attributed to disapproval of doping or a failure to understand how he should be perceived, whether he should be claimed or not.
You know, we've seen in this country what a difference it makes to the level of interest for a sport when a rider from that country is doing well. We saw last year at the Tour de France when Froome crashed out, the sort of drop in interest here. And Spanish are very proud of Contador, have been very proud. But inevitably, when he's been stripped of titles, when he's getting bans, etc., I think the media in particular has to take stock of that. And they can't celebrate him to the same extent. I mean, we can't pretend that Spain as a country is morally bankrupt. There is a certain degree of disapproval that has to be. And I certainly don't think for that reason he's resonated to the same extent that Indurain did, when Contador has been a much more exciting rider. He's not a fantastically charismatic personality, but has certainly got more charisma than Miguel Indurain had. However, because of Alonso, because of Nadal, because of Spain doing, and the football team, of course, and this has been an unprecedented era of success for Spanish football. The doping and the confusion that's created has given Spanish media a convenient excuse to focus on those other fantastic successes rather than the success they've had in cycling.
I mean, it has coincided with a real golden era in Spanish sport elsewhere. Pedro Delgado won the Tour, Miguel Indurain won the Tour, Federico Bahamontes won the Tour, Luis Ocaña won the Tour. I think that's all the Spanish Tour winners, isn't? Oh, Carlos Sastre, how could I forget? 2008, Carlos Sastre. Oscar Pereiro, how could I forget Oscar Pereiro? But the point I'm trying to make very clumsily is that they haven't, the perception that Spain is a major cycling nation is perhaps incorrect, because they haven't produced, produced, as you say, strong riders in the Vuelta, but internationally they haven't really punched above their weight, have they?
From the cobbles of Belgium to the tops of the Alps, you're listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast with Richard Moore, Lionel Burney and Daniel Freeb.
Let's hear part two now of our interview with the Vuelta director, Javier Guillen. Thank you, Daniel, for nodding at that. Let's hear part two. He talks a little bit about this year's Vuelta and the route and what he hopes will happen.
For sure, 2014 to me has been a very great season. Not because it's different in terms of competition, but the fight between Froome and Contador, you know, Mark. So that means that we have to combine, you know, a very good route together with a good participation. To me, the most important thing in Vuelta 2015 is 80 anniversary commemoration. You know, we mark 80 years old, which I think is very important. Following that argument, let's say that, we have tried to match tradition and innovation. And we combine 80 years anniversary, innovation, and we keep our philosophy. Many top finals, all the stages show something, you know, in every stage you can see a different history, you know, and now everybody is discussing about tour philosophy, Giro philosophy, world philosophy. To me, the most important thing is the first week, you know. This is what we have tried, always focus, you know, and we give that, because you see the Vuelta route today, you'll see from the second day we have a final on top, and at the end, in the first Vuelta week, we have second day final on top. Bejer is final on top, Cazorla is final on top, Alpujarra is final on top, and Cumbre del Sol is final on top. So, five in the first week.
Javier, it's been noticeable the last few years that the races looked much better on TV. smaller roads, much more beautiful summit finishes. Is that something that you concentrate on and you think about?
Yeah, absolutely. This is something that we have learned from our big brother, Tour de France. Vuelta Giro Tour at the end is a big entertainment, for sure, respecting all the sport principles. This is not a competition where riders start and finish, you know, it's something else. Touring's package. We have a special team, you know, to design the things that we can show, we cannot show, it's important, and that's why when we design a stage, we really want to take advantage from all the beautiful things that we can show, because at the end, Spain is a very variety country, you know, from the beginning to the end. You can have the feeling that you are in three different countries or continent, you know, from the south, center, and the north. You know, you are totally right. We're focusing a lot on the TV image, you know, along the race. For sure, we want the best riders in the race, because at the end, everybody is asking for the riders. That way, we have to increase our quality, you know, to be more attractive to the riders and to show everybody that at the end, Vuelta can also justify all season. You know, if you win Tour de France, it seems that everything is done. No, we have to work on that and see all the riders that, hey, don't worry if you don't win Tour de France, you can come in Vuelta and you also can be a great rider, because at the end, a three-week race is more than a race, you know, it's an adventure. It's, you know, when you win a three-week race, you are doing something very, very, very special, because it's very, very difficult.
Javier, you said about the nine finishes that have never been used before, summit finishes. In the past, there have been good stories about how the Angli Roux was discovered, and I know in Spain, lots of fans send you suggestions. This year, are there any interesting stories about how some of the climbs were discovered?
We discover new top finals, but we keep the Vuelta essence, you know, because all of them are very, very tough. I mean, you see in Cantabria, Alto Campo, Chivoloco, we call stuff. Sunday stage, which finishes in Hito Escarandi, Sotres, it's very, very good. And Ermita del Alba, short, 7 Ks, but my friend, it's really, 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 really tough. Another important thing to us, this year we are introducing a very, very three tough mountain stages. Other years we plan two, but this year we have Andorra, we have Asturias, and the last stage is not finishing in top, the Madrid stage, the Saturday stage, you know, but it's also a mountain stage. It's more traditionally a stage than in the past. It's an homenage to let's say, the old cycling, you know. So this year, maybe one of the different things from other years is that in the last 3-4 years, always the last Saturday we finish in top. This year we don't finish in top, but Contepar, we introduced a very tough mountain stage with 3-4 calls. It's an homenage to Madrid City, because we were not last year, and this year we do full Madrid stages, you know, September 12th and September 13th, Saturday and Sunday.
So the Vuelta, we are quite a long way from the Vuelta, but it is a race that we've been talking about for the last few years, because it is, as you mentioned, Lionel, perhaps the most vulnerable of the three Grand Tours, and one that's perhaps vulnerable to a change in length, Daniel.
Well, we heard Javier Guillen there saying that he doesn't quite understand why people are suggesting the Vuelta should be reduced when they're not saying that about the Giro and the Tour. I think the immediate future of the Vuelta does hinge to a large extent on those factors we discussed, whether Spain can produce successors to this generation. You know, there are a few decent riders on the horizon. Ruben Fernandez, who won the Tour de l'Avenir in 2013, Jesus Herrada from Movistar, but you know, we wait with bated breath to see whether they're going to sort of replace the what they call the Cuatro Galácticos in Spain, the Alberto Contador, Valverde, Rodriguez and Samuel Sanchez.
And he also spoke, Daniel, about this year's route in particular. And again, the route has been a talking point in recent years, the Vuelta, at the extreme end of mountainous. And it's front-loaded this year, isn't it? A lot of climbs in the first week.
He's very much committed to a spectacular start. There are five hilltop, not exactly mountaintop, but hilltop finishes in the first, well, just over a week. A couple of other things he mentioned there in the interview, a return to the sort of mountain stage that doesn't finish at altitude, the sort of more old-fashioned mountain stage. There are three of those, and there's an absolutely brutal stage in Andorra, which has been described by various people as perhaps the hardest mountain stage a Grand Tour has ever seen.
Yeah, it's interesting that the Vuelta started to shorten its stages significantly, didn't it, in probably the late 90s, really. A few years after it had made this calendar switch from the April-May slot into the August-September slot, the character of the race changed dramatically. It's a lot hotter at that time of year. August-September is quite a spring-like race when it was held in the spring, funnily enough. But this kind of emphasis on seeking out the very hard climbs, in common with the Giro d'Italia, really, looking for steeper climbs. The Angliru was one that they discovered in the late 90s and really made a feature of the race. And they compressed all the stages down, and perhaps as a response to the doping problem, let's make it easier, less of a toll on the riders, have stages of 130, 140 kilometres instead of 200 and whatever kilometres. So the character of the race has altered. Personally, I think the reason the Vuelta suffers is it comes after the Tour. The level of interest drops off significantly. The World Championship's now so much later in the season than it was. Certainly when I first got into cycling, it was 2 to 3 weeks after the Tour de France finished, and you had all of the Tour riders there in top form, along with the Classics riders. And it really was a race where everybody was trying to be at their best for that day. And now it feels like it's just too late in the season. The Vuelta's become something of a preparation race for the Worlds, and I think the fatigue starts to set in for the watching public at some point. Personally, I think with Velon, the new arrangement between half of the professional teams to try and modernise cycling, make it more marketable, make it more television centric, try and make it more newsworthy and grab the attention a bit more. I think the problem they've got is they will probably look to try and create new events and new formats away from the established races, whereas actually I think a race like the Vuelta could be used to great effect to trial some new formats. I'm not saying necessarily anything particularly wacky, but you know, just look at how to reshape the racing. And in fact, you know, if you go back to the 80s, they had some quite innovative stages in both the Giro and the Vuelta. There was one year when the race started on the island of Tenerife, I think it was, or Las Palmas, one of the small islands, and they had a 120 man field or whatever it was, and they split it into three mini pelotons of riders. Daniel's already shaking his head.
What a load of nonsense.
Well, they had three individual mini road races, one after the other, and the winner of the quickest one of those heats took the first yellow jersey
like
of the race.
Still like that. At all. It sounds like school sports day.
Yeah, but I think that we've got to try the Vuelta. It's kind of the same format as the Giro and the Tour. I think there's just a weariness when it comes to...
What about the year in 1985 when they decided to bring down a level crossing in the middle of the race and hold up the Peugeot riders who were chasing to help Robert Miller? That's a whole other story.
And also, Lionel, we know you're flagging by that point in the season. You know, you've had your fill of Cassolet at the Tour, and you're looking forward to your Christmas turkey by then. But the last few Vuelta have been fantastic. You know, the Vuelta director said in our interview, it looks better now. You know, they're going on smaller roads, exciting finishes. It's showcasing Spain as a destination for tourism much, much better. You know, I stress again, I think the only real big problem the race has is a lack of Spanish interest in terms of contenders, and that will then translate into a lack of interest from the Spanish public. As we've also pointed out before, I think, on the podcast, it's benefited from the fact that unemployment, unfortunately, is extremely high in Spain, and it's one of the few sporting events that you can watch for free, and there are a lot of people at the roadside suddenly.
Don't get me wrong, I'm not saying that it's a, you know, a dead loss, and it should be... I have argued that it should be curtailed, cut down to 2 weeks. I think it would make it more dynamic, it would make it different to the rest of the fair. We've got two big Grand Tours, and I just think a third one is just... Now it's pushing it. I take your point that it has been an exceptional race in the last 2 to 3 years, but it's actually been the same race each time. It's been whittled down to 3 or 4 riders, all of whom are much of a muchness in the mountain. But it has, though, hasn't it? And that's one of the problems cycling has. That I'm not knocking the sport. I'm just being realistic.
But that's like saying that every football match is 11 men on either side trying to get the ball into a net.
Don't get me started. You're absolutely right.
Yeah, let's do blindfolding. I don't know, egg and spoon. There's lots of imaginative things you could do. I'd love to see your fantasy grand tour, Lionel, what you would have in terms of stages. You've got your 3 pelotons. What else do you fancy?
I'd have to have a think about it for a future podcast. What could we do to... in fact, any listeners who've got ideas for innovative stage race formats, drop us a line on Twitter, cycling_podcast.
But in all seriousness, Lionel, these different formats, these gimmicky formats, various different things have been tried in the past. They have never really resonated. They have always sort of disappeared within a year or two. You know, I think you've mentioned in the podcast before a very quirky team time trial on the Tour of the Med a few years ago at Montferrand. There have been various odd prologues in the Giro d'Italia. You mentioned it in the Vuelta as well, and they've never survived.
True. Just keep it at 3 weeks, 150 kilometer stages, and be done with it.
Brilliant. Well, we got there in the end. We should probably mention that this will excite Daniel. The track. World Championships, Track Cycling World Championships are going on this week. We'll talk about them, I'm sure, next week. We had a request from a good friend of the podcast, Theo Gegenhart, to cover more women's cycling, which we do intend to do. It's very dependent on getting to women's races as well. We don't want to sort of be talking about it at too much of a distance, I think.
Well, the women's tour comes very close to me in Hertfordshire towards the end of June. I think it is this year, slight date change, so I'll certainly be there.
Yeah, I'm off to the Wiggle Honda team launch as well next week, which precedes Het Nieuwsblad, Kern and Brussels Kern. So I'll be staying over for those and get lots of interviews and things from those 3 events. But should we call it a day for today? And a reminder that you can become a friend of the podcast by logging on to thecyclingpodcast.com, and you can hear our first Friends special, the look back of first 5 years of Team Sky. Includes an interview with Chris Froome. But that'll be it for this week, I think. Lionel, thank you very much.
Thank you. We should also just say a thank you to our editor this week, who is John Mooney. Thank you, John.
Thank you also to Nigel Brown. Daniel, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Thank you to Glass Pear for the music in this episode. For more information and to download more editions of the show, visit thecyclingpodcast.com.